I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome, history friends, patrons all, to 1956, episode 2.9. Last time we continued our winding tale, looking at the scheming behind the scenes which the British engaged in the run-up to the Suez Crisis. As far as London was concerned, the crisis had already begun. President Nasser's nationalisation of the Suez Canal forced the government to act. In Eden's mind, Nasser had to go, and he was in agreement with this alongside his French counterpart, who together had developed a scheme whereby the two countries would launch a military intervention against Egypt. As we also learned last time, Eden had begun to discover that to launch a straight-up invasion of Egypt would have been fraught with consequences. The act wouldn't have had the approval either of the United Nations, the majority of the British people, or increasingly, his own cabinet. Eden thus had to look for something of a smokescreen throughout September 56. But first, as we ended on the issue last time in a very packed episode, he would have to put on a brave and diplomatic face for John Foster Dulles, who put forward a London conference on the status of the Suez Canal as the best way for everyone to achieve satisfaction. In time, the smokescreen of an Israeli attack on Egypt could be used as his cover, but first, Eden had to keep up appearances. Behind the scenes, a great deal of time and ink was spent attempting to find legal justification for an attack on Egypt, and we'll examine the fascinating progress that this campaign made. As various figures in the legal profession took on or abandoned Eden's mission, eventually condemning it as an unsupportable legal case. We've got a great deal to get through today, so I will now take you to mid-August 1956, where Anthony Eden made just such an effort, alongside his Foreign Secretary Selwyn Lloyd, to keep appearances maintained. Twenty-two nations gathered in Lancaster House in London on the 16th of August 1956, for Dulles' vaunted conference on the Suez Canal. Greece was absent, due to its anger at London for the treatment of the Greek irredentists on Cyprus, while Egypt was absent for reasons already given by Nasser. But other than those absences, the conference promised to be a lively debate. Even the Soviet Foreign Minister, Shepalov, made an appearance. 3 months before Moscow would militarily crush Hungary, Shepalov commented that military preparations undertaken by the United Kingdom and France were not warranted in the Egyptian case. Shepalov's hypocrisy notwithstanding, the mission of drafting some kind of joint proposal, which could be put to Nasser, was got underway. The Canal Users Conference saw a large amount of diplomacy took place, but a great deal of it is unnecessary to get into, since anything of substance which was actually talked about proved mostly unimportant in the end. The Soviets opposed provisions which would enable any semblance of a Western influence to remain in Egypt, while the Indian delegate angered Nasser by claiming to be in a position to speak for him, and then flummoxed everyone by making a long-winded, repetitive speech. P. people began shifting in their seats and glancing at their watches, but India's Krishna Menon had in fact made perhaps the only valuable contribution to the conference. It was Menon's idea that an international advisory committee be set up in line with the 1888 convention idea. If anyone violated the terms of this convention, then the advisory committee, operating in league with the United Nations, would enforce sanctions. This idea intended to treat Egypt like an equal rather than as a bold child, but it didn't receive much support from those present. Only the Soviet Union, Ceylon, Indonesia, and India approved of the deal, while a consensus went behind Dulles's proposal instead. John Foster Dulles had the idea of setting up a Suez Canal board, which would advise users of the Suez Canal how to work with the Egyptians to secure the future development and maintenance of the canal. Obviously, that proposal was pretty vague, and even while the Soviets did not approve, the proposal seemed like the only logical takeaway from the conference once India's idea failed to garner enough support. With or without Russia, it seemed as though the Western allies were destined to throw their weight behind this policy. Before long, Eden began to demonstrate his flair for manipulation. John Foster Dulles, Eden claimed, should undoubtedly be the man to present this idea to the Egyptians because it was his idea and his reputation commanded respect. It was pure fluff, designed to place Dulles in a position to be offended by President Nasser when the latter inevitably refused to accept the rulings of a foreign conference. Once he was so offended, it would be harder then for Washington, after being publicly turned down by Nasser, to support Cairo once the Anglo-French scheme was put into motion. Now that they had paid lip service to the Americans, the conference could be disbanded, and Dulles would be able to see the Egyptians for what they were once they set his precious proposals up in flames. There seemed to be a great deal of arrogance behind the stiff upper lip policy of the Anglo-French governments. Even while the United States was providing a great deal of the funding at this stage for European defence, a task made easier by its swollen defence budget, courtesy of the recent Korean War, both Anthony Eden and his French counterpart Guy Mollet operated throughout these months as though they knew better and were more experienced than the naive Americans. The arrogance was of course characterized by keeping the Americans at arm's length and only drip-feeding them information where absolutely necessary. The utter shambles that this approach to relations with the United States represented was made only too clear when Washington, well enough informed by the 11th hour of what the Anglo-French were up to, refrained from intervening because Eisenhower couldn't bring himself to believe that the French and the British would be so reckless, so reactionary, and so plainly stupid when it came to sorting out their problems. We'll deal with all that in the episodes to come, so don't worry, but it's worth remembering that in the case of the question, were the public aware of the supposedly secret Anglo-French plans for war, we can look at what the officer corps of the army was saying. One individual, a Lieutenant Peter Mayo of the Royal Marines, was able to note with remarkable clarity and cynicism on the 20th of August that "We are preparing to go to war if the need arises in the next few weeks, though no one has really understood that yet. The excitement of the move, and the vague and vaguely romantic notion of going to defend one's country's rights still prevail. I imagine a few weeks of the sunny aridity of Malta will cure this. I was just thinking of what little consequence it would be if I were to end my life next month in some obscure brush with some obscure Egyptian. The whole thing would be senseless and insignificant, and I doubt it would make much difference to the world." In the last episode, we saw how British statesmen were under pressure behind the scenes to construct some kind of legal basis for their intervention into Egypt. Tracing this discussion is interesting because its contents reveal, on several stark occasions, during some frank discussions between British Foreign Office officials, that Britain did not have a case for legally intervening in Egypt. If Britain had no legal case, then that meant that any armed action against Egypt would be illegal, likely subject to criticism or even sanctioned by the United Nations, and certainly a source of controversy at home and among allies. Tasked with constructing some kind of legal case for intervention was a man named Sir Gerald Fitzmaurice, who was the legal advisor for the British Foreign Office. It is Fitzmaurice's correspondence, perhaps more than any other, that shines a light on the crisis in British foreign policy at this stage. Fitzmaurice knew that his case was weak. He knew that his superiors in Eden and Selwyn Lloyd did not have a good or reasonable case for intervention, and it is something to behold, to watch him squirm and shift around logic to try and make that case. Since late July 1956, Fitzmaurice had been tasked with finding some legal wiggle room or justification, or some kind of precedent, anything to enable Britain to use force and keep the moral high ground. On the 1st of August, Fitzmaurice set the tone for the rest of his correspondence when he noted, "The fundamental legal difficulty in the Suez Canal case is that, although the Egyptian government are committing a number of illegalities, none of them amount, at any rate at present, to a direct breach of the Suez Canal Convention, and therefore they do not help us on the central issue on which we are seeking to base ourselves." The central issue on which we are seeking to base ourselves was a kind of ideal solution where Britain could both aggressively destroy Nasser and still appear as the crusading, morally superior, and highly concerned power, just doing the right thing. In time, as we'll see, Fitzmaurice would contend that this was not a possible combination of paths to take, but for the moment he would continue to try his best as a loyal civil servant. His letters to the Foreign Office and to Eden or Selwyn Lloyd throughout August and September 1956 tell a vivid story, so let's pick out a few. On the 13th of August, for instance, Fitzmaurice captured in frank and accessible language his view on the situation in a letter to one of the many officials in the Foreign Office who were tasked with reading his voluminous correspondence. Fitzmaurice wrote, "I have the feeling that when all this was started, it was thought almost certain that the situation would not remain static and that the Egyptians would speedily be led into doing something that would afford a pretext for armed intervention, and it was at least in part on that footing that certain military preparations were begun. I think we must now face the fact that, in all probability, we shall not be afforded this pretext, and I think, therefore, we must give some thought to how the legal experts on the matter are to be presented if we carry on an armed intervention into effect purely and simply on the basis that the canal must be internationalised, or rather, I think we must face the fact that we shall be unable to make out a legal case. The repercussions of such a situation may well be very serious and may be very lasting and far-reaching. They are, for instance, quite certain to affect our position in the United Nations and almost every question that will arise at the forthcoming United Nations Assembly extremely adversely." As if worried here that his advice may have been too close to the bone in this letter, Fitzmaurice added at the end of his telegram the following sentence, "In saying all this, I have no wish to intervene on policy matters, but I am bound to point out what is involved from the legal point of view." This was another way of saying, "Don't blame me, I'm only doing my job here," but we can sense that Fitzmaurice was suffering somewhat after having been saddled with this difficult task. On the 31st of August, Fitzmaurice got involved in a lengthy tug-of-war of sorts with Yvonne Kirkpatrick, the permanent Under-Secretary for Foreign Affairs and a stalwart interventionist. Fitzmaurice began the exchange by noting that, "The position is that, except under very limited circumstances, resort to force in the sense of armed force is now illegal," before adding that these circumstances included an attack on one's territory, on one's forces, or the lives of one's subjects. Fitzmaurice then added a further revealing note to the effect that, "It is certainly tempting to try and extend the notion for self-defence to the defence of one's property and interests abroad, and I have myself tried to argue that way in the past, but it is impossible to get very far with the argument. It inevitably results in an extension of the notion of self-defence so great as to let in almost anything that a country chooses to regard as involving the protection of its interests. There is not a single modern authority that supports so wide an interpretation of the idea, and it has to be regarded as confined to the three cases I have mentioned." Kirkpatrick replied to Fitzmaurice's frank note by claiming that the Suez Canal was as important to Western Europe as the Nile was to Egypt. Fitzmaurice swatted this argument aside and provided a further caution for Kirkpatrick to consider, writing, "On the assumption that we intend to intervene in Egypt, I should feel happier if we were devoting more time to creating an adequate legal case for ourselves, if that is possible, since I believe that by acting without it and in clear violation of the Charter, we shall be making a serious mistake for which we shall pay heavily in the future, whatever the immediate political or economic advantages may appear to be now." Fitzmaurice knew what Eden's government intended to do, so he took it upon himself to shield that government from any accusations of illegality. Less than a week later, on the 5th of September, he had fired through his latest progress in building for Britain a legal case for intervention. In a minute headed "The Suez Canal and the Use of Force," Fitzmaurice got straight to the point, noting that, "Leaving aside such possibilities as a complete breakdown of law and order in Egypt, or a general attack on British lives, or an attack on British naval or other forces, it would seem that either we shall have no legal case for armed intervention in Egypt, or else our case will have to be founded on one of two possible bases, insofar as we can bring ourselves within what is required in order to give us an adequate justification under those heads. They are, first, the doctrine of so-called necessity, rather than a backhanded doctrine, since it is founded on the maxim that necessity knows no law, but one to which international law does, nevertheless, within certain pretty stringent limits, afford recognition. Second, the principle established in the Corfu Channel case, which was heard some years ago before the International Court of Justice, that where a passage right exists and is forcibly or deliberately denied or obstructed, it may be asserted by force, either directly, if the passage of a warship is concerned, or indirectly by a warship escort, if a merchant vessel is concerned." Fitzmaurice, try as he might, was still clutching at straws. What stands out to me is the hearkening back to the infamous scrap of paper line given out by a thoroughly vexed German foreign minister on the eve of the First World War in 1914. Recalling the treaty which Britain, Germany and several others had had with Belgium, the official line given by Bethmann Hollweg was this, that the moment when war was breaking out, it was a time of necessity, and necessity knows no law. Were the British now about to use this justification for their attack on Egypt? It seems impossible that Eden would have adopted such an impolitique line, but it is nonetheless indicative of the extent to which Fitzmaurice's legal argument was degenerating that it was even mentioned at all. Fitzmaurice's legal argument was becoming creakier by the day, but he did not yet give up. He searched previous legal cases where incidents in international waters had enabled Britain to make use of force in the past. While scouring these cases to find some precedent, though, Fitzmaurice was forced to conclude on the 6th of September that "the result seems to be that the chances of establishing a legal case on this basis would be very slight. We might show the existence of a considerable danger arising out of the canal situation, but it seems very doubtful whether we could show that this danger was of such a nature that it really imperiled the existence of the United Kingdom, or that there was no other effective means, short of the use of force, by which it could be dealt with."
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Despite Fitzmaurice's dreary conclusions, though, it seemed that neither Kirkpatrick in the Foreign Office, nor Selwyn Lloyd as his superior, seemed to have gotten the message. Could a dust-up resulting from some Egyptian obstruction of a British ship not permit the British to intervene in the canal? This string, which the Foreign Office kept pulling, was the Corfu case, or Corfu decision, wherein it had been ruled that Britain was permitted under international law to use force to defend its interests if one of its vessels were obstructed. Fitzmaurice, likely tiring of the ridiculousness of his job by this point, was forced to send the following lengthy memorandum to the British Foreign Office on the 7th of September 1956 in response, saying, "Apart from any general breakdown of law and order in Egypt, or direct threat to British lives there, it would seem that the only circumstances in which a seizure of the canal area could be brought within the scope of the Corfu decision would be if both A. Nasser was actually denying passage to our ships through the canal, or a situation had, through his act, arisen in which the operation of the canal had broken down, and B. this situation could not be remedied or passage rights asserted except by a complete military seizure of the canal zone. Short of a seizure of that kind, all that the Corfu case would warrant would be that, if an attempt was made to obstruct passage for a British warship through the canal, she would be entitled to assert the rights of passage by force. Or again, that if a British merchantman was refused passage, we should be entitled to escort her with a warship, and of course the warship would be entitled to return any fire. But such a position would not really, taken simply by itself, warrant the sending in of an expeditionary force in the course of a specially prepared and mounted operation in order to seize the canal zone." There it was, a straightforward and frank statement by the legal expert in the British Foreign Office to the effect that Eden's government could not make a mountain out of a molehill and present this mountain as the casus belli against Nasser's Egypt. This wasn't all, though. Fitzmaurice had apparently been so shaken by his task to craft a legal case out of thin air that he decided to write to the Lord Chancellor's department, perhaps in an attempt to go around the Prime Minister and his Foreign Secretary. The permanent Under-Secretary in the Lord Chancellor's department was the man on the other end of Fitzmaurice's revealing letter in this case, and even while he described its contents as courageous and important, Lord Kilmure, the actual Lord Chancellor in Eden's government, was not to agree. In any case, Fitzmaurice wrote that, "I would like to draw your attention, and through you, if I may, that of the Lord Chancellor, to the fact that it is precisely this question of the use of force, rather than the question of the legality of the nationalisation, which is now preoccupying international legal opinion, and I am bound to say that I myself am very greatly concerned at the situation that seems to be developing. If we attacked Egypt solely on the grounds that the nationalisation of the Suez Canal is illegal and incompatible with the Suez Canal Convention, or in order to impose an international authority for the operation of the canal, we should, in my opinion, be committing a clear illegality and a breach of the UN Charter. It would in fact be a simple act of aggression, even if not an entirely unprovoked one." In a real zinger, though, Fitzmaurice concluded that, "Very few people in this country realise the immense change that has taken place in the climate of world opinion on the question of the use of force, especially that particular use of it that takes the form of what might be called gunboat diplomacy. Justifications that would have been accepted without question 50 or even 25 years ago would now be completely rejected. Forgive me for having unburdened myself in this way. I am afraid at some length, but I feel that the Lord Chancellor is one of the few persons who is in a position to appreciate all of the implications of the matter, legal as well as political." We'll have cause to return to Fitzmaurice in the future, as he ventured to the United Nations headquarters in New York through October in a bid to investigate whether, as Eden and others were insisting, the UN Charter supported the notion of intervention in the Suez case. Fitzmaurice was adamant that it did not, and swatted away with frustrated ease all exclamations to the contrary, yet he must have known that he was losing the battle irrespective of his sound legal arguments. In seeking a second opinion, Eden and company ignored Fitzmaurice's advice and turned instead to the Attorney General, who was not a member of Eden's cabinet and thus was far behind on reading the relevant Foreign Office telegrams which had been pinged back and forth. By the middle of September, this Attorney General had had enough of being in the dark, and he wrote to Selwyn Lloyd saying so. This letter, while apparently unrelated to the Suez matter at hand, is important to take note of because it illustrates the extent to which a fix was already in within Eden's cabinet. Because they already had their pet Fitzmaurice on the case, neither Selwyn Lloyd nor Anthony Eden wanted any of the legal arms of the state poking around in their foreign affairs business, at least not until Fitzmaurice had properly constructed a watertight legal argument. This strategy was of course torpedoed when Fitzmaurice turned out to be far more aware of the situation and far less prone to the concept of falling in behind the Prime Minister than Eden and his circle may have expected. In any case, the letter of the Attorney General to Selwyn Lloyd on the 14th of September makes for illuminating reading, and it stated, "Mr. Lloyd, so far throughout the whole business, I have not been supplied copies of Foreign Office telegrams, even when they are marked general distribution. The only information I have been able to get comes to me as a result of inquiries made to Sir Gerald Fitzmaurice. I'm sure you will appreciate how difficult it is to give a legal opinion without adequate information as to the problems involved, and as occasions may arise on which the law officer's opinion is required by the House of Commons, and I hope you will not mind my suggesting that it would be a good thing if we could be kept informed of the legal questions that are under consideration, for it would indeed be unfortunate if the law officers came to a different conclusion on any question of international law to that expressed on behalf of the Foreign Office." Indeed, it would be unfortunate if the Attorney General and the Foreign Office held different legal views on foreign policy, but Eden's efforts to keep men like the Attorney General in the dark demonstrated that he and his allies likely believed that the law officers of the country already had far different opinions on the Suez Canal matter to them. This was to be confirmed when, a month later, on the 12th of October 1956, the Attorney General sent out the following memo with the attached conclusion, which stated, "It cannot, in our opinion, be said that Egypt has so far committed any act which would justify the use or threat of force by the United Kingdom in self-defence. The failure of the Security Council to take an effective decision will not in itself alter this." Set against this position was the Lord Chancellor, Lord Kilmure, the same individual whom Gerald Fitzmaurice had sent an urgent letter to in a bid to express his personal conundrum. Lord Kilmure was a loyal supporter of Anthony Eden's and traced his legal career back to the Nuremberg trials, where he had played a starring role. Now, as a committed interventionist, Kilmure was determined that the opposition of some petty lawyers with peppered wigs weren't going to prevent Britain from gaining satisfaction. He noted in a long memo on the 15th of October, in a letter to the Attorney General, that, "I am a great believer in the fact that international law is dynamic. If I had not been, I do not think that aggression would now be generally be agreed to be an international crime. I therefore think that one must, in applying the doctrine of self-defence to international entities, make the logical changes." But what were these logical changes? Well, the Lord Chancellor, Lord Kilmure, was of the thought that insisted Egypt's action was a breach of treaty, but that it also compelled Britain to act in self-defence. Kilmure tried to awkwardly wedge the Charter of the United Nations into his argument for good measure by attempting to equate the Egyptian nationalisation of the Suez Canal with an aggressive attack on Britain, which required, according to the UN Charter, the mobilisation of collective security measures. Lord Kilmure went on to note that, "It might seem to follow that a breach of international obligation not involving the illegal use or threat of force will not justify the use or threat of force by the injured state, which may, therefore, find itself the remedy. There must, however, be a clear qualification in the case of international territory or national territory marked with an international character. It is clearly within the doctrine of self-defence to resist, by force, an attempt to annex national territory by invasion. It cannot be right or good international law that international territory could be annexed by invasion and that the countries affected are powerless to act if the use of the UN Security Council veto has prevented the Security Council directing any method for righting the wrong. The fact that the territory is international makes it not merely a right but a duty to defend its integrity." As if unable to resist the tactic of Eden and Company to hearken back to a bygone age, Lord Kilmure continued that, "From the moment of Colonel Nasser's first speech, the canal was changed from an international waterway to a national possession to be used for purposes of national policy. Just as the Rhineland was remilitarized, the canal was de-internationalized.
Egypt, by her invasion of the rights of the signatory powers under the Convention of 1888, has been guilty of a crime of aggression against those powers. The fact that the Egyptians, like the Germans, operated in their own territory does not lessen the duty of the countries affected to meet the invasion of the international nature of the canal. If Egypt refuses to restore this character, then the nations affected can use force to defend it. Again, this right becomes even clearer if Egypt threatens to use force to maintain her wrongful position. But the Attorney General was not willing to take Lord Kilmure's pontificating lying down. In cooperation with several underlings in the department, a draft was given to the Attorney General wherein all of Lord Kilmure's points were taken apart. The Attorney General described the draft as wholly excellent, and one extract of it particular stands out. Remember, these are the group of legal officials, independent of Eden's administration, who were looking at international law as it stood in 1956 and concluding that Britain simply did not have a sufficient legal case for intervention. After swatting away Lord Kilmure's efforts to define the Suez Canal Company as residing on international territory, the Assistant Legal Secretary in the Law Officers Department then concluded, "If peaceful methods are ineffective and the United Nations refuse or fail to authorize the use of force, a state injured by breach of an international obligation not involving the threat or use of force may find itself without remedy. That result appears to have been accepted by the International Court of Justice as an essential part of present framework of international law. It is this result which laymen find most difficult to stomach, but there can be no doubt of its correctness. Indeed, we know that many in Eden's cabinet found this idea very hard to stomach, and that they were working hard not merely to formulate some kind of excuse for intervention and cloak this intervention in legally acceptable language, but that the idea of satisfaction was foremost among their motivations. The Suez Canal was a valuable waterway for sure, but it was, by autumn 1956, merely an excuse for Eden's government to try and do away with an Egyptian figure who had for so long frustrated and embarrassed them. So Eden continued to order research be done into how to best frame Britain's intervention in legal terms. He also continued to pay lip service to the underwhelming fruits of the London conference, which we opened the episode with, where the Australian Prime Minister, rather than the American Secretary of State, was sent to Cairo to present the Allied offer. This Australian Prime Minister, a friend of Eden's, blundered his way through the meeting with backhanded threats and disrespectful talk, and he would leave Cairo empty-handed. Above all, though, throughout the latter half of August, Eden engaged in a pressure campaign against the Americans, in particular against the President. Eisenhower was in no mood to humour him, having made his position on the Suez matter very clear already. Yet, almost in a bid to shut the Prime Minister up, he cabled to London the following memo on the 2nd of September 1956. It is a long extract in an episode where we've heard a lot of extracts already, I understand, but I really do feel these primary sources are the best way to express what was really going on back then, and this extract here is an important one because of its clarity of purpose and stark central message. Washington, as Eisenhower stated here plain as day, would not countenance any British use of force against the Egyptians. In fact, the Americans argued determinedly against such a measure. Eisenhower said, "Now that the London conference is over, our efforts must be concentrated on the successful outcome of the conversations with Nasser. This delicate situation is going to require the highest skill. I share your view that it is important that Nasser be under no misapprehension as to the firm interest of the nations primarily concerned with the canal in safeguarding their rights in that waterway. And of course, there should be no thought of military action before the influences of the United Nations are fully explored. If the diplomatic front we present is united and is backed by the overwhelming sentiment of our several peoples, the chances should be greater that Nasser will give way without the need of force. I am afraid, Antony, that from this point onward our views on the situation diverge. As to the use of force or the threat of force at this juncture, I continue to feel as I expressed in the letter John Foster Dulles carried to you some weeks ago. Even now, military preparations and civilian evacuation, exposed to public view, seem to be solidifying support for Nasser, which has been shaky in many important quarters. I regard it as indispensable that if we are to proceed solidly together to the solution of this problem, public opinion in our several countries must be overwhelmingly in support. I must tell you frankly that the American public flatly rejects the thought of using force, particularly when it does not seem that every possible peaceful means of protecting our vital interests has been exhausted without result. Furthermore, I gravely doubt we could here secure congressional authority even for the lesser support measures which you might have to look to us. I really do not see how a successful result could be achieved by forceful means. The use of force would, it seems to me, vastly increase the area of jeopardy. I do not see how the economy of Western Europe can long survive the burden of prolonged military operations, as well as the denial of Near East oil. Also, the peoples of the Near East and North Africa, and to some extent all of Asia and all of Africa, would be consolidated against the West to a degree which, I fear, could not be overcome in a generation, and perhaps not even in a century, particularly having in mind the capacity of the Russians to make mischief. Before such action were undertaken, all our peoples should unitedly understand that there were no other means available to protect our vital rights and interests. After this refreshingly frank and unmistakable critique of the interventionist policy, coming from a quarter of the world where Eden desperately needed the support, one could have expected the British Prime Minister to give up on the Suez Canal issue and to let the matter quietly die down. Yet Eden was not so deterred. While he received this memo from President Eisenhower on the 2nd of September, the private battle over the diplomatic legal lingo would continue until at least the middle of October. It was then that, in a memo from the Attorney General's department, both the Attorney General and his peers in the legal office provided our considered views on the question whether, if the Security Council fails to make an effective decision, international law will in any circumstances permit the use or threat of force by us against Egypt. Both the Attorney General and Solicitor General noted that they had by this point come, regretfully but without hesitation, to the clear conclusion that, as matters stand now, there are no such circumstances. Eden's allies would continue to search for a wiggle room and to argue until the cows came home over these legal issues, but they only went around in circles in their arguments over the interpretation of international land, of the notion of self-defence, and of the necessity of using force. By the middle of October 1956, in other words, Anthony Eden's government would have been handed several damning arguments against intervention alongside the French, against President Nasser's regime. The Prime Minister, it was plain, got over these objections and holes in his strategy by blithely ignoring them. As one historian has noted, just after Eden had received Eisenhower's conclusive rejection of any idea of military intervention in Egypt, he, Eisenhower, may well have added, "Is that plain enough for you, Anthony, or should I come over to spell it out in capital letters?" Maybe he should have done just that, for Eden persisted in believing that it was only the threat of force, with the real prospect of carrying out the threat, which would secure British and French objectives. Later protestations from Eden's part that he hadn't been given enough information on how the Americans would react, or that the legal implications had been unclear, were all lies. Anthony Eden's cabinet holds the distinction not, as he would have liked, as the British government which clawed back the country's prestige after a downward trend. Oh no. Instead, Eden's government stands out as perhaps the most conspiratorial in British history. Not since the machinations of King Charles II of England, in league with Louis XIV of France, to first lie their heads off and trick, and then destroy the Dutch Republic in 1672, does a British government so stick out to me as one full of dishonesty, and actually with dishonesty as its baseline. This is less criticism than just a pure observation. The parallels of 1672 are also something to behold. Here, like Charles II had nearly 300 years before, was a British leader scheming alongside the French to gain the prestige and satisfaction that he desired. In 1672, there was no powerful America or Cold War, but there was a great deal of collusion and plotting in private, while in public a very different face was put forward of British intentions. At least, though, in 1672, Charles II could claim that the Dutch were not like to cross his domains. But in Eden's case, the memory of the Egyptian Act was not even well understood, and the efforts to rouse the British public behind a reactionary course had been far from successful. Next time, we continue our narrative of these heady days as we delve into how the freshly minted country of Israel fit into the equation, with some revelations that I think may well surprise you. Until then, though, my lovely history friends and patrons, my name is Zach, and this has been 1956 episode 2.9. Thanks so much for listening. It's great to be back, and I'll be seeing you all soon.